You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to N2K CyberWire's Hacking Humans podcast, where each week we look behind the social engineering scams, phishing schemes, and criminal exploits that are making headlines and taking a heavy toll on organizations around the world. I'm Dave Bittner, and joining me is Joe Kerrigan from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Dave.
We got some good stories to share this week and are joined once again by our N2K colleague and host of the T-Minus Daily Space Podcast, Maria Vermasis. Maria.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
Good. It is delightful to have you back. We will be right back after this message from our show sponsor. But first, a word from our sponsor, KnowBefore. Where would InfoSec professionals be without users making security mistakes? Working less than 60 hours per week, perhaps. Actually having a weekend every so often. We get it. User behavior can be a challenge. But users can also be an InfoSec professional's greatest asset once properly equipped. What do we mean by that? Well, stay with us, and in a few minutes, we'll hear from our sponsors at KnowBefore on that very question. All right, we are back, and before we jump into our stories here, we have some quick follow-up from a kind listener who wrote in. This is a listener named Leo, who wrote in and said, just finished listening to episode 282. This is where we were talking about recruiters, and how do you know if someone is a real recruiter or not? And Leo said, my thought, ignore everything the recruiter gives you in terms of contact information. Call the company they claim to represent. Ask to talk to the recruiter. No such recruiter? Scam. If the recruiter exists but has no idea what you're talking about? Scam. If they exist and can confirm they've reached out to you, full speed ahead. And Leo says, maybe ask them to confirm their direct number. He says, I still like the idea of always calling the company directly for any or all contact. So, yeah, I think Leo's got some solid advice here. Everybody agree?
Yeah, good logic tree there. I liked it. Scam, yeah. Not scam. Yeah,
right. It's I can imagine the flow chart.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good practice to keep in mind. And it is more work for people who are looking for jobs, but it's worth, you know, protecting yourself, especially if you're in a sort of vulnerable state.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's move on to our stories here. I'm going to kick things off for us here. So let me ask the two of you a question. Let's say you are a big-time Mexican drug cartel.
All right, okay. Right? I like this question.
Right. I'm in.
Just imagine yourself, things are going great.
Right.
You know, like you're intimidating the local towns. You're shipping the things across the border that you're doing.
I'm selling so much cocaine.
Yes, you have and you are a cartel that has a history of being involved in drug trafficking.
Right.
But you know, businesses die if they don't grow.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
So it's time to diversify.
Okay.
Well, this story is about the criminal cartel from Mexico called the Jalisco New Generation, who have decided to diversify to not only have drug trafficking, but they're going to be defrauding seniors through timeshare scams.
Okay.
Oh, it's like they're going legit. It's less bad or something. Less bad than murdering people? I don't know.
Can I correct you on pronunciation?
Sure.
It's Jalisco.
Jalisco. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's a state in Mexico.
Muy bien.
Yes.
All right. So now that Joe has corrected me, please don't write in.
Right.
So Jalisco. I should have known that.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah. No, you're right. Absolutely. All right. I appreciate the correction.
It's also the name of one of my favorite Mexican restaurants, Tex-Mex restaurants in Texas, Agave Jalisco.
Ah, okay.
Good food.
Very good. So I know there are probably people who are listening to us who are saying that, who are thinking that timeshare scam is redundant.
Right. First thought into my head, by the way. Yes.
But what these folks are doing are actually going after folks who already have timeshares. And there are a lot of people out there who have timeshares. There are a lot of people out there who have timeshares and enjoy their timeshares. So what happens here is the cartel members, they pose as sales representatives and they call people who have timeshares and they offer to buy those timeshares for high amounts of money. And now, and timeshares are notoriously difficult to get rid of.
Yes. In fact, there are legal companies here in the U.S. who have a business model that is helping you get out of a timeshare.
Yes. And it seems like that's who these folks are trying to emulate. That's who they're pretending to be. And I think the fact that there's awareness that that sort of company exists probably plays to their favor here.
Yes.
So they will call someone up, offer a high sum of money, and then demand upfront fees for services to help get you out of your timeshare. But of course, they're never actually going to buy your timeshare. The whole thing is a
just an advance fee scam.
It's an advance fee scam.
Yeah.
And these folks have set up call centers in Mexico, and they're primarily targeting American and Canadian timeshare owners.
Now, are they targeting people who have timeshares in Mexico?
It seems like they're targeting Americans and Canadians who have timeshares. And I don't know, I'm not 100% sure if they're deliberately excluding their countrymen and women in Mexico.
What I'm asking is the timeshare physically located in Mexico?
Some of them are. Yeah.
Okay. So like if I have a timeshare like in Ocean City, Maryland, are they still going to target me? Is that a risk?
I think yes. I think they might.
Okay.
I think they'll go after anybody who they can verify has a timeshare.
I see.
And I suspect that that is not a difficult list to buy, right?
Yeah.
They've set up some call centers here. An interesting note is that reportedly they are bribing some of the employees at the resorts to get the information about the guests.
Ah.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So they don't even have, well, I guess they do buy it, just not legally.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, most of these folks that they're going after are older folks. A lot of retirees have timeshares. And a lot of them are trying to get rid of these timeshares because they want to, rather than passing on the timeshare, they want to liquidate the timeshare and pass on the assets to their families.
Right.
And like we said, it could be hard to sell a timeshare, and you often don't get out what you put into it, which is, you know, nature of the beast, I guess.
Right.
Often.
What's that, Maria?
I was going to say, often don't get out what you put. I don't know much about them aside from they're supposed to be giant scams, right? So,
right.
Did anyone ever end up on top except for the people who sell that timeshares?
I don't know.
Well,
I've always been afraid to even consider a timeshare as an option, just because there are lawyers out there, lawyer companies out there who sell the service to get you out of them. I don't want to get into something that I'm going to need a lawyer to get out of.
Yeah.
I think what it comes down to is that, this is my hot take on this, is that—
Hot takes.
Yeah. A timeshare is not an investment in terms of you're buying property that you're then going to sell at any point and make a profit on.
Right.
I think a timeshare is an alternative to money that you would be spending on a vacation or travel or whatever. So the value is that you can have pretty well-known cash flow. You're going to know what the timeshare costs. You're going to know what you're going to pay every year. And if you balance that against, let's use Disney World as an example, right? If you go to Disney World every X number of years, you could buy a timeshare down in Orlando and you can run the numbers and see, well, is this timeshare going to cost me less than what I pay for, you know, our family vacation that we take every year, every other year. So, you know, you can run the numbers and see if it makes sense. I think the problem is that a lot of the timeshare industry is full of folks who are not honest, who are not upfront and end up giving people bad deals.
Yeah.
So. But I don't know, I guess it's a high enough percentage of folks are that way that they've earned this bad reputation, but I honestly don't know if that's universal. And
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I also don't know how much money we're talking about, like how much a timeshare usually costs, or I have no clue.
Yeah. Well, this story talks about how one retired couple was defrauded of nearly $900,000.
Oh my gosh.
By the cartel through a series of escalating fees and non-existent fines and also investment opportunities. So it sounds to me like the cartel found they had a hot one on the line.
Yeah, and just drained them.
Drained them, right. And it wasn't just the timeshare that they got them on the hook for other investment opportunities. And
right.
Away they went. And cartels being cartels, this story talks about one cartel-owned call center. There were some folks who were found murdered.
Oh,
so there's, it's just not, certainly not a victimless crime.
No.
And these cartels are brutal. And of course, it's hard for law enforcement to go after these folks because they're not in our country.
Right.
And
they essentially have armies around them.
Right.
You know, they're, these cartels are well armed.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the bottom line is here, just, you know, make sure that you and your loved ones are aware of this and extra cautious. If you do have a timeshare or someone calls you looking to help you get out of your timeshare, there's a chance that it may be one of these criminal organizations who are trying to take advantage of you. I have to say, this was a new one to me. Like, if you'd asked me, list 10 things that a Mexican cartel is going to pivot to business-wise, I wouldn't have said timeshare scams.
Right.
But it just goes to show you, they'll chase the money wherever it is.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Wow.
Yeah. All right, that's what I have this week. Joe, you want to tell us your story next?
Yeah, I had a connection on LinkedIn named Keith who posted a link to a TechCrunch article. And we'll put a link in the show notes, of course. But in 2013, Facebook acquired a company called Onavo,
yeah.
Which is designed, or described rather, as a VPN-like service. Now, I don't know what that means, VPN-like.
Is that like kosher style?
Right. Yeah.
The diet like
kosher
Coke
style
of
ham and cheese.
Yeah.
Right.
Kosher style.
It's not actually secure. It just kind of feels that way.
Right. Yeah. They in 2019, Facebook shut this site down when TechCrunch reported that they have been secretly paying teens to use the service.
Yeah, I remember that.
So in mid-March, a federal court released some new documents that are part of a class action lawsuit between some customers and Meta now. And it seems like Meta was very concerned about the competition they were receiving from Snap, who are the owners of Snapchat.
Right.
Dave, are you a Snapchat user?
Nope,
me neither. actually, I have an account. I don't have the app on my phone. Maria, Snapchat?
I used to, a very long time ago, but not anymore.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, when it was new and I was a social media manager, it was my job to figure out how to do this kind of thing. And
oh, right.
Yeah, it's been a very long time.
As a social media manager, it's great. I'll tell you, I have never felt like such an old man as when I was at Grace Hopper and a young lady from Snap came over and was showing me how to use Snapchat. And I'm like, but there's no buttons on it. She goes, you don't need buttons. You just swipe to do different things. And I'm like, I don't like this very much.
Tactile feedback, yeah. Yep.
Right, yeah. So Facebook, very concerned about the competition they were getting from Snap. So they started a project, and they gave it a really cool name, Project Ghostbusters.
Mm.
Now, the ghost is the logo for Snap, right?
Yes.
For Snapchat.
Yep.
So there was an email that was dated June 9th, 2016, that was part of this document set that this court released. And in that, the Zuck wrote, and I'm going to quote from the email that's from the article from TechCrunch. Whenever someone asks a question about Snapchat, the answer is usually that because their traffic is encrypted, we have no analytics about them. Given how quickly they're growing, it seems important to figure out a new way to get reliable analytics about them. Perhaps we need to do panels to write custom software. You should figure out how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, panels or write custom software. You should figure out how to do this. So in another email that came out a month later, July of 2016, the Onavo team, Onavo, I just can't look at that word and say it for some reason. They proposed a solution. They said kits that can be installed on iOS and Android that will intercept traffic and for specific subdomains. And they said, and this is another quote, this will allow us to read what would otherwise be encrypted traffic so we can measure in-app usage. This is a man-in-the-middle approach.
Yes, it is.
Okay. A later email said, we now have the capability to measure detailed in-app activity and then from parsing Snapchat analytics collected from incentivized participants in Anavo's research program. Okay, so this is what's happening. Facebook is paying people, mostly they're targeting teens and anybody under the age of 35 to use this Anavo product, right? Then they are using this Anavo product to intercept their traffic that's going to Snap.
Yeah.
Okay, right? Yep, all right.
So they can get the analytics. Later on, the project was expanded to include traffic that was going to Amazon and to YouTube, which is Google's product.
Right.
Right?
Yep, yep.
Now, there's a man here, Pedro, I'm going to mess up his last name, Kanahati, who is then head of security engineering. And he expressed a little bit of concern. He is now actually with 1Password, but there's a quote in an email from him that said, I can't think of a good argument why any of this is okay. No security person is ever comfortable with this, no matter what consent we get from the general public. The general public just doesn't know how this works.
Yeah, good for him for saying that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's not with Meta anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if I don't know why he's not with Meta, but this was in 2016, and I looked at his LinkedIn post. He left pretty far after that. I don't know exactly when, but it wasn't like this. It wasn't like that's it. I'm out.
Yeah.
I've seen some questions on how are they doing this? Like at the bottom of the article in the comments and in other LinkedIn posts. One person has asserted that they are, actually two people have asserted that Meta is installing their own root certificates, which I think is probably the correct answer. Because if they can install their own root certificates, then all the traffic will be trusted by the device. So whenever you see somebody asking you to install a root certificate, there is almost never a good reason to do that. The one exception to this is that some DoD sites require that you install DoD signed, self-signed root certificates because the DoD has a concern about that being those certificates, the certificate chain that's outside of their custody being corrupted. So that might be a good use case for this. But other than that, I can't think of another reason to do that.
But wasn't this on mobile devices?
It was on mobile devices.
Okay.
So those mobile devices still have certificate stores on them and trusted root certificates.
Okay.
And I know I'm getting down to the cryptographic weeds here.
Yeah.
But these certificates are trusted throughout the internet, and there are certain people who issue these trusted root certificates, and then they use those to sign other certificates, and it's all signed all the way back down, right? It's all signatures all the way down to the website and then back up, and you can verify the entire chain mathematically. But if I just put a new root certificate in there, I can verify anything mathematically from that root certificate.
And the goal is?
And the goal is now when your device starts sending traffic to the VPN software and I present to you my root certificate, your device goes, okay, I trust this root certificate. Here's all the information that you need to encrypt or that it needs to be. So in other words, the app, Snapchat app might be thinking that it's talking to Snapchat, but it's actually talking to another trusted root certificate.
Okay.
So the bottom line here is that Meta was able to snoop on
right
Snapchat traffic that
correct
was that Snapchat was saying is was telling its customers and its users that this stuff is all end-to-end encrypted.
Correct. And well, it's probably encrypted with TLS, right? Which is every web page is now encrypted with TLS. But you know those firewalls that inspect packets, encrypted traffic?
Right.
They do the same thing. They have their own certificate that has to be installed on the endpoint. And then the endpoint trusts that device. And then it looks inside the packet, the unencrypted packet. It's essentially impersonating the main website.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's all it's doing is this app could be impersonating the website. Now, there's another option where I'm really getting technical. I don't want to do this, but they could be looking at the traffic before it gets encrypted. if they insert themselves into the code right with a properly with something called a network extension.
Yeah. Well, okay. So,
but the end result is they are looking at traffic that should be encrypted, and they're essentially intercepting traffic and decrypting traffic.
Right.
That way.
Okay.
Yep.
Joe, my question is for the end user. You had mentioned about the whole thing about root certificates.
Right.
I mean, how would an end user know any of that? I mean, especially if you're talking about on a mobile phone, is this one of those they were supposed to read the finest of fine print and see that buried in their situation?
I would bet, but I would guess that the operating system probably says asking to install a root certificate. Do you accept it? And I'm willing to bet, I've not seen this, but I'm willing to bet that there's a setup procedure that says yes and accept the root certificate. So
yeah, I could also imagine that especially if they were paying people to use this,
right,
that they're going to have a specific walkthrough where they're going to say, so next the OS will pop up a screen that says, do you accept the root certificate?
Yeah, this is expected. Just hit yes.
Click yes, right, to get your $15.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So, this is, I don't know. I do you think that...
It's despicable, Joe.
It's a huge breach of trust. I mean, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's despicable. And, you know, time after time, Facebook demonstrates that they are a company that does not deserve anyone's trust.
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's my first question on this is why would anybody trust a VPN product from Facebook?
Well,
ever.
I doubt it was presented to them as being that.
No, they said, here's $20 a month, use this product.
Right.
Yeah, and who are the people, and this is probably teenagers using this, who probably needed the money, right? So they don't care. They're like, sure, right, Facebook can snoop on me all at once. I don't care. I don't use it anyway. And give me
they're collecting information about Snap's traffic. And my question is the next step lawsuits from Amazon, Snap, and Google? Because if I was working at Amazon, Snap, or Google in their legal department, I'd be like, they did what? They specifically targeted our traffic to learn how that sounds anti-competitive, right?
Well, at what point do you violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
Yeah,
I mean,
good
I guess
question.
they're not infiltrating someone else's computer,
Right, the endpoint is
in
the
an unauthorized way, yeah.
And they
they're
going to
say they had consent, right?
They had consent.
They
right?
had consent to look at the traffic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But
EULA. It's the EULA.
But are they violating the EULA for Snap by being essentially a customer on the other end, being the man in the middle? Because they have to maintain both ends of that communication channel.
That's an interesting point, because it would not surprise me if Snap, for example, had something in their EULA that prohibits users from doing an end around like this.
Yeah,
to me, that would seem like pretty straightforward boilerplate that would be in there.
Yeah, I would bet it is.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I could imagine someone spinning up a class action suit about this sort of thing.
This is already the result of a class action
suit. Oh, I see. Okay,
so that's what this came out from, two people who are suing Meta for violating their privacy.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to predict that this is going to result in another lawsuit from either Snap, Google, or Amazon, or perhaps somebody asking for the FTC to investigate for anti-competitive behavior, because they're deliberately trying to get analytics on Snap, another social media platform,
right?
That's a direct competitor with them, and I'm sure they could argue that they're not breaking user trust by doing it,
right?
But this all seems really, really underhanded.
But that's kind of Meta's thing.
It is. Yeah.
You know, again, let's not forget the origin story of Facebook is a hot or not database of was it Harvard grads?
Harvard
students?
Harvard grads went to the Ivies, and then,
So,
I remember
that's the foundational premise of what all this is about, where it started. I remember when I first signed up for Facebook, and it was a much, much more innocent time, and I remember being presented with the thing from Facebook that said, hey, if you upload your address book, that will help us connect you with your friends. And we can have pictures on their profiles and we can do all this kind of stuff. And it'll really be great. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that sounds great. That will be helpful.
Yeah.
Not in a million years did I imagine, again, simpler time.
Right.
That they would do all of the stuff they've done with this information. And that's what they're taking advantage of from day one. That's what they've taken advantage of people's innocence and their ignorance. And it seems like a foundational principle of the company.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes me sick.
Yeah.
Like I said, I would close my Facebook app tomorrow or my Facebook account tomorrow and ask them to delete all my information if it wasn't the only way I communicate with so much of my family.
Yeah, same here. That is the exact same problem that I have. Family and school stuff for my kid, where that's the only place this stuff is ever posted is on Facebook. I can't get off the damn thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Drives me crazy.
I heard someone say last week that Facebook is like chemotherapy. It has its uses, but at its root, it is poison.
Right.
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking.
All right. Well, we will have links to this story. And before we get to Maria's story, we're going to take a quick break here to hear a message from our sponsor. We were talking about making users into an asset for security professionals. Simply put, users want to do the right thing. They're often just lacking the knowledge to do so. That's one of the reasons KnowBe4 has released Security Coach, a real-time security coaching tool that takes alerts from your existing security stack and sends immediate coaching to users who've taken risky actions. For example, imagine a user has visited a high-risk website or tried to open a document containing malware. Existing security tools will likely block that action, but the user might not understand why. Security Coach analyzes these alerts and provides users with relevant security tips via email or Slack, coaching them on why the action they just took was risky. Help users learn from their mistakes and strengthen your organization's security culture with Security Coach. Learn more about Security Coach at knowbe4.com/securitycoach. That's knowbe4.com/securitycoach. All right, we are back. Maria, what have you got for us this week?
This one's an interesting one that comes to us via Brian Krebs at Krebs on Security. Good old Krebs. So this is a elaborate phishing attack that sort of subverted my own expectations. Instead of just plain old tricking a user into taking an action, it first pesters the heck out of them with system-level prompts on Apple devices. So Krebs has this write-up of several users that wrote into him who all experienced the same attack. And one of them, his name is Parth Patel, and he walked Krebs through it. And basically, what he experienced was all of his Apple devices all at once, so like his watch, his iPads, his iPhone, all lit up or blew up, as he said, with dozens upon dozens upon dozens of system notifications that all said, reset password, use this iPhone to reset your Apple ID password. And these were not fake system notifications. These were all legitimate. They came from his phone, and they were, you know, the gray notification bubbles with the exclamation points. And I should note that you can't ignore these notifications when they come up. It locks your phone out until you take an action. So Parth and everyone else who received this kind of attack had to go through each and every single one of these system notifications one by one and hit allow or don't allow. And in his case, he got like over 100 of these. Other people were getting them at like the wee hours of the night. But again, dozens upon dozens of this barrage of system notifications just forcing you to take an action. Otherwise, you can't use any of your Apple devices until you've cleared them all. So I'm just imagining if I got one of these or if I got hundreds of these all at once, I would get so annoyed. I'd probably eventually just go, ah, heck with it. Allow. Why not? Let me just reset my password.
Right. Make it stop.
Please make this go away. I'm just trying to get on with my life. I have no idea what's going on, but like this is, some people figured they like sat on their phone, you know, you butt dialed the system prompt. I can imagine people going, ugh, whatever. And so when you do that, you will get texted from Apple a one-time password to reset your password. One-time password to reset your account, I should say. And
right.
This is where the scam becomes apparent, because also coincidentally, if you go through all of these notifications and hit don't allow, or if you do the allow, you get a phone call from Apple support. And I'm using air quotes around Apple support right now.
Right.
Great on an audio only podcast. Nobody can see me doing
right,
that.
Yeah.
Apple support with the official number even showing up on your phone saying, hey, I think you just got a reset prompt. Could you share that code with me? And I'm sure all our listeners know that's a big, big red flag that, you know, you never share that kind of code with anybody, and that somebody calling you for that, no matter how much of your PII they offer up, it's a scam. And thankfully,
right.
The folks who read Krebs are very, very savvy and they know this. So they all hanged up on the calls and said, you know, we'll call you back or whatever. And none of them fell for it. Essentially, that is the scam. You get pestered to death. MFA bombing is what it's called.
Right.
You get pestered to death to initiate that password reset process. And then somebody pretending to be from Apple support will call you and ask for it. And then if you offer up that information, the scammers can initiate a password reset on the account, lock you out, and then even remotely wipe your device. So that is the attack. There is not a great mitigation for this yet. Apple really needs to rate limit the password reset.
I was going to say,
yeah.
I got a great
there's a great mitigation, right?
Great mitigation right now. Rate limit that.
Yeah. I don't know why they haven't done that. Hopefully, maybe by the time this episode publishes, they will have done this, because this is a pretty new attack, apparently, on Apple devices, even though MFA
bombing
is not new.
Apple does a pretty good job.
Yeah.
No, MFA bombing is not new, but this is we've not seen this with Apple before, but we can assume this has been there for a while as a vulnerability.
Absolutely. So, Joe, my question to you is, what is the incentive for the attacker to do this, to MFA bomb you and then wipe your device?
They get access to your account.
Mm-hmm.
And when they wipe your device, they lock you out of your account. That's probably why they're doing that. Maybe there's some value in your account. Maybe there's, because if you have your iCloud account that you have all your images, maybe they want to ransom that to get it back from you. I'm thinking of how I would monetize this were I a bad guy. The first one is I could ransom back their account to them, say, you know, you don't get your access unless I get $1,000. Look at all these pictures of your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things.
Yeah.
God forbid you've been doing something you shouldn't do and taking photos of yourself that you send to your very close people.
Right? Mm. Yep.
Yeah. You have those on there. Let's see what else. Sell the account as a way. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an Apple user. Does Apple give you access, or can you access other services? I think you can access other services with Apple, right?
With your
Apple ID.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So,
and it tries to get you to do that, actually. Apple really wants you to do that.
Right.
There's all these sign in with Apple prompts on every app I can think of now.
Yeah. I get that with Google as well. Being an Android user, I never make use of that. I have a password manager. I use that to keep my authentication separate, just because of exactly this kind of reason.
Mm.
If anybody ever does compromise my Google account, they will get access to my Google account. They will not get access to anything else because I just don't use it. I guess maybe they can get access to my Zillow account because I do just click on it for there because it is easy. And what do I have on Zillow? Nothing. Here's some houses I've saved around my house. Because I want to see
stalking your
see
neighbors
what
a little
for.
Bit, yeah.
No,
he's, he's slowly building a compound,
right.
By buying up all the houses on his street.
That's why I have all the land favorited out in West Virginia. That's where the compound's going, Dave.
The compound,
right?
Fair enough. I'm curious with this. Do we suppose that in order to trigger this password reset, are you already past the point of stuffing the credentials? Right? In other words, do you already have someone's username and password to get to the point of triggering?
You have their username. I don't think you have the password. I think you're utilizing...
Because that's what you're trying to reset
your password.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, or at the very least, their phone number, I think, was the other thing that Krebs was saying, is that through any of the bazillions of leaks, our data has been leaked through at this point.
Right.
At some point, someone's phone number got offered up, and that's what they're trying. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean... That's the interesting thing to me also is there were sort of suggestions at the end of Krebs's post, which are always helpful about like, what can you as a user do? And it was sort of like, you know, maybe try to use like a Google Voice account or something to fake a phone number when you put your phone number in online, which I know some security users, savvy security users do that. Security users is not the term I should use, but security savvy folks, I should say.
Right.
But I was just trying to think, like, if this happened to someone I know who's not a security savvy, what would my advice be aside from obviously don't give up that code if someone calls you?
Right.
Like, if you're getting bombarded by an MFA bombing attack, like, aside from just turn your phone off and throw it out the window, what the heck do you do?
Right. Yeah, this happened with Microsoft Authenticator in a recent attack. It was over the summer, over last summer that happened. It wasn't the Twitter account hack. That was different. That was a social engineering attack. But this, well, I mean, I think MFA bombing is a social engineering attack. You're wearing somebody out. You're fatiguing them.
Yeah.
You know, my big concern is that you, is that, because I think I actually read some of this article from Krebs, and Krebs makes a point, you could fat finger the response and accidentally hit the yes, I want to authenticate my, you know, I want to change my password from this phone.
Yeah.
And then you get the code and you get the phone call. And now you've escalated yourself to, you know, to front and center of the scammer's attention. And that's kind of a dangerous place to be.
It sure is. Yeah. Well, let's hope that Apple fixes at least the rate limit on these password reset requests. So then this won't be a possible attack vector for them, for attackers.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Apple will come up with a good solution to this. I mean, one of the things I've always said about Apple, even though I'm not in the Apple cult, is they do a really good job of keeping their users secure. That is a priority for them. So much so that Tim Cook one time made a comment about, if you think that we should sell our user data for bigger profits, I want you to sell Apple stock because this isn't the stock for you. He told investors to do that, to sell the stock.
Yeah.
Which I think is bold. No other CEO has ever said that. But I think he understands that's part of their competitive advantage. So absolutely. I think they're going to come up with a good solution here. I would like it to happen very quickly though.
Agreed.
Well, yeah, I would suspect that it's having someone as well known as Krebs on this will certainly get their attention.
That will expedite it.
Yep, sure will.
Yeah. All right, terrific. Well, again, we will have a link to this story in our show notes, and we would love to hear from you. If there's something you'd like us to consider for the show, you can email us. It's hackinghumans@n2k.com. Joe and Maria, it is time to move on to our cash of the day.
Dave, our catch of the day comes from Van, and it's another voicemail catch. So Van writes, it sounds like Joe's social engineering calendar is correct again, which is great. Maria, have I explained to you my social engineering calendar?
I'm pretty sure I know what it is. I can...
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the liturgical calendar in
like
churches.
Every year, a certain time of year, certain scams come up. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
like recently we were in Lent. Now we're going to be in Pentecost. Well, here we are, right before tax season. We're in tax fraud.
Joe, I'm Orthodox. Season. Lent just started for me, FYI.
Oh, are you Orthodox? So Lent didn't just start for the Orthodox. Is it?
I'm in week two.
Week two?
Yeah, my Easter is not till
Sunday.
May. Easter's
okay.
In May for me. I'm just saying.
Anyway.
Listen to Dave. Listen to the Catholic and the Orthodox argue about what Easter is. We need an ecumenical council.
This is exactly what people want to hear on Hacking Humans.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Right.
I want to know when the solid chocolate bunnies go on sale. That's what I want to know.
That will be Sunday afternoon when I will be buying them for my kid.
That's right. Go. There's your advantage to being Orthodox.
It's
you
true.
Can buy all the... Right.
Yeah.
Van sent this voicemail along. Dave, do you want to play it?
Sure.
Hey there. Happy Monday. Bill over at the tax group calling about your past filings. I'm at 943-218-9030. We show you might be one of the people that still has some past taxes owed, and our company helps you get enrolled in the new zero tax program. Any small or large amounts that you may have would be basically non-collectible through the program. Give us a call back. We can help you get set up. It doesn't take very long. It's a one-and-done setup. I'll keep the account open through the end of the week. And again, my number's 943-218-9030. Thank you.
Well, Joe, this seems totally legit to me.
Does it?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, it's not... The dogs barking in the background or whatever. I mean, zero tax programs.
Right.
Sign me up.
Yeah, it sounds like some guy, and I don't even know if this is real or synthetic audio. I mean, it sounds like it might be a little synthetic. It might be some guy just leaving you with a voicemail. I don't know.
Sounded real to me. I mean, I have to say, it sounds like it's right out of an episode of Better Call Saul.
Okay.
Right.
That or the attackers are scaling and they are using artificial voices and the dogs are to make it sound real.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah, that's true.
Van notes that this is a low pressure strategy. You know, like, hey, you want this thing? They give us a call. But they do have the artificial time horizon of call us by the end of the week, because that's when we'll close your account. I want to advise everybody of this. There is no such thing as a tax zeroing program. A zero, you know, like if you owe the IRS money, you're going to owe the IRS money.
And also, the IRS will tell you.
Right.
They will write you a letter.
They will write you a letter.
Ask me how I know.
They will not.
I know how you know, Maria.
Yeah.
It's not because I'm Greek. Don't say that.
No.
Greeks and taxes is sort of a notorious thing. I've never heard that.
I was not aware of that.
Oh, well, you know.
Okay.
I leaned into my own stereotype that you didn't know
about.
There you go.
Hadn't heard of it.
Well, I'll be cautious from now on. Right. Thanks, Maria.
I love talking taxes with my son. He gets very stressed out when I start telling him stuff. And he's just like, because he's an accountant.
I was going to say, you like talking about taxes in general?
Well, actually,
so Maria, his actual knowledge runs up against your willingness to bloviate about things, regardless of whether or not you actually know about them.
No, I just tell him. Here's what I'll do. I'll just ignore this letter from the IRS. He goes, "Don't do that."
Now I get it.
Right.
What are they going to do?
Shoot me?
Yeah, you're using the letters from the IRS as kindling, and he's like, "No,
setting them on fire." What is that? I don't know.
I'm sure if I ignore this, it'll sort itself out. Whatever. Yeah.
I don't know. Final notice, huh?
Who takes that seriously anyway?
No, I take every letter I get from the IRS very seriously. Whenever I see IRS in return letter, that gets my undivided attention. In fact, we've talked about this before, that if someone were to use this kind of attack on me, they would immediately have my attention. Not this voicemail attack, because I know right off the bat, no, there's no such thing as a zero tax program. But if somebody says, hey, I'm from the IRS, they immediately get my undivided attention because I grew up in a house with accountants. I come from a pretty large accounting family. a lot of accountants in my family.
Giving up too much info.
Surprising number of accountants in my family.
Okay.
Unmitigated fear that people have that has been instilled in me with the IRS. Like I've actually, in years past, somebody said, hey, do you want to work as a contractor for the IRS? I said, absolutely not. Nope. My family, there are members of my family, large sections of my family would never talk to me again if I did that.
Wow. I don't know. I mean, I understand the fear. My experiences with them have all been pretty good in that even when they have given me undue attention,
right?
The people that I've worked with there have all seemed to be reasonable people, and
I'll agree with that.
Just looking for a good outcome for everybody.
I've made phone calls and gotten really great people on the phone who have answered the exact question, the question with the exact reason I called.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks to Van for sending that in. Again, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is hackinghumans@n2k.com. We want to thank all of you for listening. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors at KnowBefore. They are experts in helping users do the right thing through new school security awareness training. That is our show. We want to thank all of you for listening. Our thanks to the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute for their participation. You can learn more at isi.jhu.edu. Maria, please share with our audience what is the best way for them to find out more about the T-Minus podcast.
Well, our website is space.n2k.com, and you can also find T-Minus Space Daily in all your favorite podcast apps.
N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Iben. The show is mixed by Trey Hester. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie. I'm Dave Bittner.
I'm Joe Kerrigan.
And I'm Maria Varmazes.
Thanks for listening.